Any problems out on the freeway? Any problems on the freeway?
There's a couple accident fives in Jim, but typical 5 south of Jim.
Okay.
There you go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let me begin by offering you the opportunity to raise any questions you may have from Saturday or the readings.
Is this kind of, with the approach, would you say this is a little bit a Darwinistic approach to Darwinistic philosophy behind that if we let economic forces progress in a natural direction, you know, unchecked by government forces that would inhibit or outside into that inhibit the free forming of the market, that the economy will continue to expand in the appropriate or in a healthy path, and the natural destiny of a truly capitalistic form of market is to have would be a healthy world. But I bring up the idea of Darwinism because I think it's, you're talking about the, it's addressing in kind of way an evolution of economy.
Okay. Mr. Cunningham asks, are we developing or expanding a kind of Darwinistic approach to the economic system? When one uses the word Darwinism, there's the very strong, irresistible implication that it means survival of the fittest, the weak perish, the strong survive.
Well, let me clarify what I mean by Darwinism in terms of the natural force that lets a balance that is the healthiest balance for that environment.
Well, again, there's still that implication,
because
Darwinism implies the survival of the healthiest members of the species, and the weak members die off.
Yeah.
No, that has nothing whatever to do with economic competition or the economic philosophy that I'm developing here. And a good illustration, which we didn't get to last week, or Saturday rather, which we should have, and it's my fault I omitted it, this very last point under the previous subject, the dependence of the division of labor on economic inequality. Point 5, economic inequality and the ability of the less able to compete against the more able. Well, a major proposition of, let me give it a name for you, because there is a long-standing tradition in the history of economic thought, which I don't think is taught any longer, or very rarely. You might be very surprised at the name. The name of the economic philosophy is known as economic liberalism. Economic liberalism. And you can look it up in any decent dictionary, and you'll find that economic liberalism is the doctrine of economic freedom, laissez-faire capitalism. That's economic liberalism. And a major tenet of this economic philosophy is that the rightly understood self-interests of all human beings are harmonious. There is a harmony of the rightly understood self-interests of all human beings. And that can be seen in connection with the competition. And I'll spend an awful lot of time on that about 2 weeks after the midterm. But let me give you one indication of it here under the heading economic inequality and the ability of the less able to compete against the more able. One of the aspects of the harmony of interests is that there's room for everybody within the division of labor economy, all the way down to people who are intellectually barely functional, if you have an IQ of 60 or better, there's room for you in the economic system at the appropriate level. Everybody has a role to play. And what assures a role, what makes room for the less capable is their accepting a lower income. Their lower income offsets their lesser capability and makes them desirable employees. I'll give you an elementary example. Suppose we have two bricklayers, one of whom can lay twice as many bricks in the same period of time as another. You can take two workers of any kind, one of whom can do the job twice as quickly and better as the other. All right, what's required to make them equally costly to an employer?
Well, the better one would be double the pay of them.
Okay, if the better one is twice the pay of the poorer one, right?
Right.
And if the poorer one has less than half the pay, then he has the positive competitive advantage. All right, and this principle operates to enable what, for want of a better word, a better expression, you could term productive morons to outcompete literal productive geniuses. So to take a very, very extreme example, let's suppose that Bill Gates is just an all-round superhuman being, that there is nothing that he can't do better than virtually everybody else. And that ranges on down to being able to be a better janitor in a Microsoft factory than any janitor Microsoft employs. So let's imagine Gates, if he had to work as a janitor, could sweep five times the floor space and do it better than any of the janitors Microsoft now employs. So he's a five times better janitor. Is this a competitive threat to the janitors?
No.
No. Why? Because Gates may be making $1 million an hour, I don't know, some stupendous figure. And putting aside social stigma and things of that kind, on a purely monetary basis, Gates, to contemplate the job of janitor, would need to be able to make $1 million an hour being a janitor, plus a premium to overcome the social opprobrium of going to work as a janitor. All right, now, who is the more economical janitor? Gates at $1 million an hour, he's five times better than the janitors Microsoft has, or an ordinary Microsoft janitor at $10 an hour? The ordinary janitor outcompetes Gates hands down. There is no question. And what enables him to do that? Well, it's that his income is lower by far more than enough to compensate for his lack of productive capability. So that's what assures him room. Now, this is the most extreme kind of example. It would be more common. There are some workers who are 10% better than others, some who are 20, 50, or 100% better. We don't have to deal with cases where there's a million-fold or a multi-hundred-thousand-fold advantage. But you have to keep in mind that what allows the less capable to compete effectively is the fact that their incomes are lower in sufficient proportion to give them the same kind of cost or a substantial cost advantage, depending on the circumstances. And that's the means by which they are able to compete. And a significant implication of this is that many, many people who think they have the interests of the disadvantaged at heart again and again propose measures that would deprive disadvantaged people of their means of successfully competing. Can anyone think of any significant instances in which people who profess to be humanitarians and concerned with promoting the interests of the less capable and the disadvantaged are advocating measures that deprive the disadvantaged of their ability successfully to compete against more fortunate people?
Maybe those that demand equal pay.
Yeah, if you demand equal pay for unequal workers, that would be one way. Or if you're demanding any kind of above market rate. Suppose we have a situation, one category of bricklayer is twice as efficient as another, There's room for the less capable if his wage is half or less than half of the more capable worker. But suppose we impose wage rates which make it illegal for his wage rate to be half or less than half. Imagine the wage scale would be the more capable worker would be getting $10 an hour, the less capable worker would be getting $5 or $4.75. That would enable him to be successful in competition. But if we enact a law, no, he must be paid $7 an hour. No one can be employed for less than $7 an hour. Well, what does that do to the competitive advantage of the less capable worker? It wipes it out. So he loses his ability to outcompete the more capable worker. And this is what happens routinely under minimum wage and pro-union legislation. And then there can also be the fact that as you raise a wage rate in a given line, additional people are attracted to that line who otherwise would have been working in other lines, and they're drawn into competition with less capable people. So this is actually a counterproductive, self-defeating measure, which people who claim to have good intentions propound again and again simply because they're ignorant of elementary economic theory. Now, it's not so bad to be ignorant of something. It is bad to persist in ignorance when the knowledge is readily available all around you in the society. Yes, Mr. Wilson, I seem to have struck a humorous chord there. But why is it so funny?
You have this observation, like there are so many economic ignoramuses out there, and it frosts you. It's just a funny comment that we hear again and again.
Okay.
I enjoy it.
All right. Okay. Yes, Mr. Severin.
Just a thought. We kind of ended on the note talking about Saturday.
Yeah.
Referring to healthcare situation and
yeah.
socialism and basically saying that the healthcare system, the way it's set up, is destined to self-destruct for several of the reasons that you brought up. One being people are maxing out those benefits. There is no cost, people keeping that cost in check.
Mm-hmm.
So I see that.
Yeah.
At the same time, I look at the other side, talking about a free market situation where we just let the market decide how the healthcare system's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
There's the worry that our self-interest is not going to take care of the quote-unquote community in a way that we'd all want. And so
mm-hmm.
when you come to a certain place in an economy or when you've become civilized to a certain position, you'd like the thought that Big Brother's going to be there to help that one person that can't pay for it themselves. And so these programs get set up with that good intention. But I guess my concern is taking that away and saying, okay, let's try to see if a free market situation is going to work. What kind of risks do you see us being exposed to as a community as far as hurting that person that can't pay for it themselves?
Well, there can always be risks to people who can't pay for it themselves, and there could be major problems in a transition. So I doubt that the transitions could be made in its entirety overnight, but it should certainly be worked towards. And then the effect is, as I tried to explain Saturday, to make healthcare progressively better and ever more affordable. So, but I don't want to repeat that whole discussion.
Basically, in the long run, the free market's more effective, but it's to get there, there might be some collateral damage. And so we'd have to manage that as a society. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, we'd want to do things that would minimize any damage. Yeah.
Got it.
All right. Now, what I would like to do is get into the next major subject, demand and supply, and hopefully finish it well before the end of tonight's class so we can get into the uniformity of profit principle. And let me start off by briefly explaining what I refer to as classical demand and supply. the classical economists, the school of economists, starting with Adam Smith in 1776 and going on down to John Stuart Mill who died around 1870 or 71, they viewed demand as an amount of expenditure of money, And they viewed supply as the quantity of a good put up for sale and sold. So they thought of demand as an amount of spending and supply as the quantity of a good put up for sale and sold. And on that basis, they viewed prices as formed by the ratio of the demand to the supply, the amount of money spent divided by the quantity sold. That was their view of demand and supply. And this is a simple type concept of demand and supply. I don't think it's too difficult to understand. And one of its virtues is that it makes immediately clear that we should expect prices to move in the same direction as demand and in the opposite direction as supply. More demand, more expenditure for the same quantity produced and sold, the higher would be prices. The lower the demand, the lower would be prices. Just divide a given sum of money, or a greater or a smaller sum of money, by the same quantity of goods being sold, and you see that prices are higher or lower as the demand is higher or lower. So prices move on this conception proportionately to demand. They move in the same direction and in proportion to demand. And then, of course, prices move in the opposite direction of supply, in inverse proportion to supply. If we had the same expenditure and twice the quantity produced and sold for the same expenditure, then prices would be halved. If we had half the quantity produced and sold for the same expenditure to buy them, to buy the goods, prices would be doubled. So I say in point two, this makes clear the relationship between the direction of price changes and the direction of demand and supply changes. This concept, this view of prices, though, encounters a major problem when we look at things on the microeconomic level, as we'll see very shortly, and that is that changes in prices can themselves be, and should be expected almost always to be, the cause of major changes in expenditure. So if the price of certain goods goes up, the expenditure to buy those goods may go up, or conceivably it could go down, depending, as we'll see, on whether the demand for the good is elastic or inelastic. Nevertheless, these classical concepts still have a value. They're still especially valuable in the realm of macroeconomics, where we can reasonably proceed as though the aggregate spending can stay the same in the face of changes in production and quantity sold, because the aggregate spending, there are good reasons for showing, is determined by the quantity of money in the economic system. So if we had the same quantity of money, we could reasonably assume the same volume of spending, and then the general price level would move in the opposite direction of production and supply. And as we would have more money in spending, prices would move in the same direction as money in spending. Okay, but now we want to turn right away to B, contemporary demand and supply. And these are conceptions that in some ways go back to John Stuart Mill since well before the end of the 19th century. These have been the concepts that have prevailed. And in this view, the prevailing view, supply and demand are to be understood as schedules, and when diagrammed as curves, and more specifically, the schedules, what a demand schedule or supply schedule represents is, as I put it here, the set of quantities That means the full array. The set is the full array of quantities buyers are prepared to buy or sellers to sell at varying prices, arranged in descending or ascending order, all other things being equal. So nowadays, what is understood by demand in economics is typically not the amount of money spent, although it's still used that way sometimes, but what is meant generally is the demand schedule, the set of quantities of something buyers are prepared to buy, all other things being equal. And by supply is meant a set of quantities that sellers are prepared to sell at varying prices, all other things being equal. In both instances, there's a set of quantities demanded or a set of quantities supplied at varying prices, arranged in descending or ascending order, all other things being equal. And perhaps the best way to get into this is to present a hypothetical demand and supply schedule. And this is from page 152 in my book. And what we have here, if you notice, over on the left in the first column, we have price, and we have an array of prices. Starting at $10 and going down in $1 increments down to $3. Now, strictly speaking, we could move the price by pennies or by mils, and we could extend it below $3, on down to zero, and on up as high as we liked, to infinity. And the argument is that all other things being equal, and that really means all other things being equal. It's quite a huge array of things. All other things being equal, at each price, there will be some definite quantity demanded. So here, for the sake of illustration, we're assuming at a price of $10, the quantity demanded will be 100 units. At $9, 125. On down to 500 units being purchased at a price of $3. And the demand schedule, the way to think of a demand schedule is, the demand schedule is the totality of this of these first two columns taken together. It's a set of points. The demand schedule, if we graph this, each of these pair of data represent a point on a diagram. At the price of 10, the quantity demanded is 100. 9, 125. 3,500. And the totality of these prices together with the respective quantities demanded at those prices, that totality is one demand schedule. And we could have further elaboration if we moved it in increments of a penny or increments of a mil, and it could be extended on either up or down. And the totality of all of the quantities demanded together with all of the respective prices at which the quantities are demanded, that represents one demand schedule. So the demand, or the demand schedule, is the totality of the first two columns. That's a demand schedule. And similarly, a supply schedule is the totality of columns 1 and 3 taken together. The total array of prices in the price column together with the total array of all of the quantities supplied at each of the respective prices. That would be one supply schedule. Okay, but now what we would want to do is to diagram this information. And we'll diagram the first two of the schedules. And here we are. We have, actually we have two different demand curves and one supply curve. And we want to focus on this first demand curve labeled DD and this supply curve labeled SS. where do we get the information to make these diagrams? Well, these numbers are the exact same numbers that appeared in that first column. Prices starting at $10, ranging down all the way to zero. And here we have, on the horizontal axis, we have the set of quantities that are demanded or supplied. And this demand curve, DD, proceeds from that demand schedule. So at the price of $10, if anyone has the text available to them, what is the quantity demanded at $10?
100.
100. At $9, what's the quantity demanded?
125.
At $8?
160.
160. Okay, and hopefully I've drawn that correctly. And at $7?
200.
200. And on there, $6 is something more. What is $6?
250.
Okay, 250. So what we have here is, I guess it's 8 different points that we plotted, and then we drew lines connecting the points, and this is how we got the demand curve. We got the demand curve is the reflection of the various quantities that people will buy at the varying prices with the prices arranged in descending order. I'm sorry, what? I'm missing something?
My system broke, I'm sorry.
Pardon me?
I'm with you.
Okay. All right, so this, a demand curve is simply a demand schedule presented in diagrammatic form. And notice, this is one demand curve, one demand, and this one demand embraces all of the points lying on this line, and actually lying further if we extended it. This is one demand that embraces all of the quantities demanded at all of the prices, all other things being equal. And that has to be stressed very strongly, all other things being equal. And now this supply curve, well, this is a diagrammatic presentation of the supply schedule. We've got the same range of prices, and at each price, it was assumed there's some definite quantity demanded. At a price of $3 or less, there's no quantity, there's no quantity supplied. At $4, what's the quantity supplied at $4 given the supply schedule matching columns 1 and 3, yes?
50.
50, okay, well, here's $4, here's 50, $5, a little bit more. What is it, $5?
100.
Okay, and at $7, it happens that it's 200. And notice, at $7, the quantity demanded is 200 and the quantity supplied is 200. And that, in contemporary economic theory, would be described as the equilibrium price where demand and supply are equal. It's that price at which the quantity demanded and the quantity supplied are equal. Now, what would happen if the price were higher? Suppose the price, given this demand and this supply schedule, suppose the price were higher than $7. What would be the effect on the quantity demanded?
Less.
It would be less than 200. And what would be the effect on the quantity supplied? It would be greater than 200. So at that point, we would have an excess of supply over demand. And what effect would that have on the price? Pardon me?
The price goes down.
Okay, it would drive the price down. So if the price is above 200, there are forces at work, namely the reduction in quantity demanded and the increase in quantity supplied. There are forces at work that are operating to drive the price down toward 200, expand the quantity demanded from wherever it is below 200 up toward 200, and reduce the quantity supplied from greater than 200 down toward 200 if the price is above 7. Similarly, if the price were below 7, then let's say 6, well then the quantity demanded exceeds the supply available and the supply would actually be less. So we have an excess of demand over supply, and what would be happening then? Then the price would be driven up. So it would rise above 6 towards 7. Only at 7 is the quantity demanded and quantity supplied in balance. Any other price implies either an excess of supply over demand or an excess of demand over supply, both of which are tending to move the price to the point of balancing the demand and the supply. And such a price would be called an equilibrium price. Now, I'll explain shortly this second demand curve labeled D prime, D prime. It shouldn't be surprising to you that that is the result of plotting columns 1 and 4. Let's see if we can show that. Here we are. This final column, labeled quantity demanded 2, here something else has changed. Not everything is equal as between this quantity demanded and this. There is a different factor present here compared with here that has operated to change the demand. At the same set of prices, we have now a different array of quantities demanded. And that, when diagrammed, shows up as the demand curve D prime, D prime, and that would represent an increase in demand. If we have greater quantities demanded at the same set of prices, that's an increase in quantity demanded. I'm sorry, an increase in demand, an increase in demand. We'll say a little bit more about this shortly. What I want to turn to right now is the law of demand, the law of demand. This is a proposition considered so strong that it has the title of law. And the law of demand is that other things being equal, the quantity demanded of a good, other things being equal, the quantity demanded of a good increases as the price decreases. The quantity demanded will be the greater, the lower is the price, and it is the less, the higher is the price. The quantity demanded, other things being equal, and we always have to keep in mind that caution, other things being equal, the quantity demanded changes in the opposite direction of the price. The cheaper something is, the larger the quantity demanded, other things being equal. The more expensive, the smaller the quantity demanded, other things being equal. Which implies that if you want to sell a larger quantity, you can do so if you charge a lower price. If there's a smaller quantity for sale, if the supply available for sale is less, that can bring a greater price. Now, let me turn. First off, let me check. Is there anyone unclear as to the meaning of the law of demand? Or the meaning of a demand or supply schedule? Or curve? All right, well then let's turn to the reasons for the law of demand. And there's actually an additional one that I should insert here that I don't have on the list. We can see it at a certain level based on our proposition that our need and desire for wealth has no limit. Now, this is something that is perhaps easier to understand at the level of the economy as a whole. But if it's true that there is no limit to our need and desire for wealth, then if we have the same given monetary means, if we were earning the same money incomes, if we had the same power to spend money, if we were in a position to spend the same number of dollars, and we want more goods and services rather than less, why should we expect that lower prices would result in an increase in the physical volume of our purchases?
Because we're spending less money, therefore we have more money or income per se.
When you say we're spending less money, do you mean, in what sense do you mean we're spending less money?
To buy a certain product.
Spend less money to buy a particular product or a particular quantity of a particular product, that leaves money left over, right? And if we do need and desire more products than we've been buying, well, what presumably will we be doing with the money that we no longer spend in buying the given quantity of that given product?
Buying those other
products. Maybe buying more of other things, or possibly more of that product, or some combination. But we would be buying more. You could look at it this way. We're eager to obtain more goods and services. And other things being equal, a fall in prices creates the means whereby we can obtain more of goods and services. It's creating purchasing power. It's enabling whatever funds available to us, whatever the funds available to us are, it's enabling them to buy more. So it's putting us in the position of doing what we already want to do. We would like more goods and services, and the fall in prices generates the ability to buy more goods and services with the same expenditure of money. So that by itself, I think, is a very good reason for thinking that lower prices operate to increase quantities demanded. But as I indicated, this would be working more clearly at the macroeconomic level. So let's go further and turn now to marginal utility. Recall Saturday we had some discussion of the law of diminishing marginal utility and pointed out that the more of any good that one consumes or possesses, the lower is its marginal utility. Now, for people to buy anything voluntarily, what kind of valuation must they attach to the money they spend for the item compared to the valuation they attach to the item that they're obtaining?
Greater.
Which has to be greater?
The
marginal utility of the item they're obtaining has to be greater than that of the money they're spending. So let's imagine, for the sake of illustration, that the price of something is $10. Now, who will be buying this item or trying to buy it, and to what extent in terms of marginal utility? How would you relate marginal utility to the quantity of an item demanded that's being sold at an asking price of $10.
I'll buy it until the marginal utility of $10 is greater than that of the product.
Okay, the quantity that people would be attempting to buy is that quantity whose marginal utility exceeds $10. They would be attempting to buy whatever the number of units is, the last least valued unit of which is still more valuable than $10. So let's imagine that at the price of $10, people are prepared to buy, in the aggregate, 1 million units. Now, what does that imply about the marginal utility, even of the 1 millionth unit, to whoever is buying that unit, compared to $10?
Marginal utility of $10 is less.
Okay, the marginal utility of $10 is less than that of the millionth unit. Or, by the same token, the marginal utility of that millionth unit is greater than $10. Okay, why aren't people attempting to buy more than a million units? Why aren't they attempting to buy 1,000,001 units?
The marginal utility is lower.
Because the marginal utility of a potential millionth and first unit is less than $10, so they don't try to buy that. All right, now, what would be the effect if, instead of $10, the price were only $9? Then what number of units would be purchasable? How far could the purchase proceed if the price were only $9 rather than $10? What would have to be true of the units purchased compared to the price of $9? Yes, Ms. Fox?
The marginal utility of the product must either be exceed $9.
Okay, the marginal utility of the product at a price of $9 would only need to exceed $9. Now, this means that all those units whose marginal utility is less than $10 but greater than $9, whatever those units are, what will be the effect of the price being $9 rather than $10 on the quantity of the item demanded?
It'll be purchased.
all of those units whose marginal utility is less than $10 but greater than $9 would now become sought. People would be attempting to buy them because the utility of the item now need only exceed $9 rather than $10. In effect, we're lowering the bar. An analogy perhaps would be, think of some kind of standing high jump. If we have the bar raised at 6 feet, well, how many people can, from a standing position, jump over a 6 foot high barrier? Well, I don't think very, very many. But what happens as we progressively lower the barrier to the number of people capable of jumping over a lower barrier? It goes up. And if the barrier is set at 2 inches, well, then practically everybody can jump over it. Well, you should think of the price as constituting a barrier to the purchase. In order to purchase something, we have to attach a value to whatever it is greater than the price. And the higher the price, the more difficult that is, the fewer the units that we will value above that price. But as the price is lowered, that means first that more people become able to afford their first unit. They will attach a higher utility to the first unit than to the price if the price is lower. And people who would be buying some units at the high price, well, now they can afford to buy additional units because a lower price may well be below the utility of their second unit or third unit or whatever. You can think of this in terms of practically of the price of practically any good. If a new television set cost $1,000, then only those people could buy television sets who attached a value to the TV of greater than $1,000. Then there'd be some people, if they were quite well off, they might still be buying a second or third set. They might attach a greater value to set number two or three than to $1,000. If a new television set costs $100, well, this means that practically everybody can afford at least one television set, and vast numbers of people may very well be able to afford sets two, three, four. Many people may have a television set in every room of their house. So the lower the price, the lower is the barrier, the lower is the bar that marginal utility must exceed. We're making it possible for marginal utility to be greater than the price more easily the lower the price is. The lower the price, the greater the number of units whose marginal utility will exceed the price. And those units will now be sought. People will attempt to buy the units whose marginal utility whose marginal utility is greater than the price. And so the lower the price, the larger the number of the units whose marginal utility surpasses it. So that's a very major reason why quantity demanded rises as the price falls and would fall as the price rises. Any questions on this? All right, well, let's turn to still further reasons for the law of demand. And B, named the substitution effect. Well, what that refers to is all those cases in which the same need or want can be met by two or more goods. This is something very, very common. For example, our desire for meat can be met by a variety of things, by beef, chicken, pork, fish, and I'm probably leaving some things out, but certainly there's a variety of meats out there, and while they're not perfectly interchangeable with one another, they're not radically different. They're serving the same need or want. So in this way, the one is a substitute for the other. Similar situations in containers. We can make containers out of glass, out of aluminum, out of cardboard, out of plastic, and probably other materials. And each type of material for making containers is a substitute for all the others. We can make clothing out of wool, cotton, polyester, various other fabrics. So the case of substitutes is a pretty common one. Now, the law of demand, if you recall, says that other things being equal, the lower the price of a good, the greater the quantity demanded, the higher the price, the smaller the quantity demanded. Now, if we apply that literally, this means that if we're talking about the price of beef, let's say, if we're asking what must be the effect on the quantity of beef demanded if its price were higher, and we keep in mind that beef has various substitutes, chicken, pork, fish, etc. Well, we're implicitly assuming that while the price of beef is higher, among the other things being equal are the price of chicken, pork, fish, etc. So if only the price of beef is higher, while the price of the substitutes is unchanged, how do you think that would affect the quantity of beef demanded and why? Yes, Ms. Fox?
It would decrease because you have the other products to substitute.
I think the other products would be substitutes, and why would they now be in a stronger position?
Because the marginal utility did not meet the price.
Well,
it's lower than the price.
The marginal utility can be brought in as an ultimate explanation, but if we think of beef, pork, chicken, etc., as being in competition with each other, there are limits to how much you can eat at a given meal, and even if you were having a mixed grill, let's say, well, if a third of the mixed grill is chicken, another third is beef, and the third is pork, well, each third is mutually exclusive. To the extent that you have the one, you can have the other. They're in competition. And what's the effect if the price of one of these is now higher and the others are unchanged?
The demand for the other three goes up.
The demand for the others would go up. The competitive position of the substitute whose price has risen while the others have not, its competitive position is impaired. Their competitive position is improved. So we should expect that people will switch from the higher priced item, the item whose price has just risen, to the substitutes which now have a competitive advantage because their price has not risen. And you could think of this, I suppose, in terms of marginal utility too. To the extent that the price of beef is higher and chicken and pork, etc., are unchanged, this means that as you shift your spending from beef to these other things, what are you doing to the funds available for still other things? Suppose beef goes from $10 a pound to $12 a pound. What does that do to the money you have available to buy things other than beef? It's reducing it, but if you shift to things other than beef, pork or chicken or whatever, you're not suffering that reduction or as much of a reduction. And so you're able to obtain, you have more money left over to buy still other things. And that's the source of the advantage. All right, hopefully you can see that if the price of a substitute rises, that is going to reduce the quantity of it demanded because people will be shifting from it to the other things, to the other substitutes. You can think of the fact that as the price of any good that is in competition with other goods goes up, while theirs stays the same, its competitive position worsens. People shift money away from it to other things. That's reducing the quantity demanded of it. There'll be a smaller quantity of it purchased because its price is higher, because its competitive situation has deteriorated. Now, by the same token, if the price of a good that has substitutes and can serve as a substitute, if it goes down, then what's the story? Pardon me?
It's the opposite.
Then it's the opposite. Then its competitive position is enhanced, and we should expect people to be shifting to it from the other substitutes. So this would make the quantity demanded increase. Well, this is known as the substitution effect. The substitution effect. Yes, Mr. Feldman.
Question. So is this making the assumption that the quality of the beef versus the pork and the chicken is about the same?
No, it's not making the assumption that it's the same. Different people can perceive these things in different ways, but to the extent that the different ones can serve the same need or want, though not in as good a way, as the price goes down of a substitute, it will be in a stronger position. As its price goes up, it's in a weaker position. So you could have people, let's say steak is $10 a pound, and people are buying it. They don't particularly care for fish at all. Maybe they like chicken somewhat. And maybe chicken is $5 a pound, but they're prepared to pay $10 a pound for steak because they like steak much better than chicken, or that steak better than additional chicken. But now what happens if the price of steak is not going to stay at $10 a pound? It'll be $12 a pound, while chicken is still $5 a pound.
Move towards chicken.
Then there'll be some who'll likely move. I mean, it's conceivable you could have a situation where no one moves as yet, but still it would be the case that now if you're buying the steak at $12 rather than $10, there's less of other things that you're able to buy. While if you were buying the chicken and its price were unchanged, you're not in a poorer position in terms of the still other goods that you can buy. Now, there'll be many people who might continue to buy steak rather than chicken, even though its price is $12. But what happens if the price is $14 or $15? You can see that the greater the disparities, the greater the likelihood of people shifting, and there'll probably be some people. If we're talking about a very large market with millions of people, probably every change in price would produce some change in quantity demanded, and a bigger change would have a more profound effect. Now, there is yet a further effect explaining implying the law of demand, and this is known as the income effect. And where this comes from is the fact that to whatever extent people were already planning to buy some definite quantity of something at a definite price, and certainly this is the case with many, many people at any given time, the price is whatever it is, and at that price, people are prepared to buy such and so much. Well, now imagine that price were going to be higher or lower. If the price were higher, what would be the effect on how much money would have to be spent to buy the same quantity at the higher price? That much more. And what, of course, would that do to the funds available for other things? It would reduce it. And if the price were lower, it would make funds available because you could get that quantity for less money. All right, these changes in the quantity of money that have to be spent if the price is higher or lower, by virtue of their absorbing funds from other things if the price is higher, or releasing funds to other things if the price is lower, this gets the name income effect, because it's very, very similar to what happens when your income changes. See, suppose instead of the price of something going down, imagine in the course of a year you'd be buying 100 pounds of beef. If beef is $10 a pound, that means in the course of a year you're spending $1,000. If instead beef were $8 a pound, then you're only spending $800. You'd have $200 made available. Well, that $200 that's made available is regarded as the equivalent of $200 of additional income. Conversely, if the price rose from 10 to 12, you'd need to spend $200 more to buy the same 100 pounds of beef. That would be regarded as a $200 decrease in your income. And then you can consider, well, what effect should there be on the pattern of purchasing if an individual's income decreases or increases? How are purchases affected if your income increases or decreases?
Either increases or
decreases. Okay, if your income increases, that should be something operating to increase purchases. If your income decreases, it decreases purchases. Now, to the extent that a fall in the price of a given item, like steak, to the extent that by way of its equivalency to a rise in income, to the extent that such a rise in income would itself result in an additional quantity purchased of steak, that would be called the income effect on the demand for steak. See, here we are. There are people prepared to buy steak or whatever at the prevailing price. To the extent that that price falls, that quantity can now be purchased for correspondingly less money. And the reduction is regarded as the equivalent of an increase in income. And then to the extent that such an increase in income would itself result in a rise in the quantity of steak demanded, well, that's the income effect in the demand for steak. Now, this income effect I don't think is particularly big. Just imagine if people's incomes rose by some modest percentage, to what extent do you think they would be spending that additional income on any one particular good? Imagine that we had an increase in income more or less throughout the economy. You can think of some of the one of the recent tax cuts. It put an extra few hundred dollars in the hands of millions of people. Now, how did that show up?
I would say home improvements were probably
okay. Home improvements in many cases, but I doubt if most of it showed up in home improvements. I'm sure a wide variety of things. Clothing, some extra movies, restaurant meals. There would be a huge variation depending on the individuals involved. Now, to the extent that what generates such a thing is a fall in the price of a given good, I doubt that there is very much increase in the quantity demanded of that particular good. There may be some, but I don't think it would be particularly valuable, powerful. It would be extremely unlikely that if the price of steak falls 10%, the quantity demanded of steak by way of the income effect would have any substantial rise. The substitution effect, I think, would be substantially more powerful. What's the major effect, do you think, in terms of changes in income or general buying power? What's the major effect of a change in price of a given individual good? Well, in terms of the quantities of goods purchased. By me?
You mean the increase in the amount of goods?
Yeah, where would the most of the money sit, most of the money released, where would that be spent? On the good whose price fall created the available funds, or on the rest of the goods in the economy? I think on the rest of the goods in the economy. So the main effect via generating the equivalent of additional real income is really not to increase the quantity demanded of that particular good. There'd be some effect, but a limited effect. The main effect will be to increase the purchases of all other goods at unchanged prices. So The income effect is something, the major effects of which are changes in demand for things other than the good whose price has changed. There's some effect in that on the good whose price has changed. That's the income effect. This is very, very closely related to the next point, six, the distinction between a change in quantity demanded and a change in demand. The distinction between a change in quantity demanded and a change in demand. Now, we can look at it first in terms of these demand schedules. Here we have changes in quantity demand. Does the movement from here to here to here, does this represent a change in demand?
Yep.
I suppose I gave you a two-choice, multiple-choice question.
Oh, no.
This, the increase in quantity demanded from 100 to 125, et cetera, as the prices are falling. This represents A, a change in quantity demanded. B, a change in demand.
A.
A change in quantity demanded. Remember, the demand, one demand schedule, all of this is one demand schedule, one demand. This is movement within a given demand schedule. These changes in quantity demanded within one and the same demand, that doesn't represent a change in demand. It represents movement within one and the same demand schedule. The demand is the full array, the whole set of these prices and quantities. It's the combination of $10 and 100 quantity demand, $9 and 125. You can think of it as $10, 100, $9, 125, on down to $3, 500. That whole set of points, that whole set of pairs of values, that's one demand. And it's diagrammed as how many demand curves?
One.
It's one demand curve. It's showing different prices accompanied by different quantities. That whole curve is one demand. So the changes in quantities demanded that are the result merely of a change in price of that good, all other things being equal, that represents a change in quantity demanded, not a change in demand. It's a change in quantity demanded along one and the same demand schedule. A change in demand is indicated by the movement from column 2 to column 4 at the same set of prices. Here, at the same set of prices, we have different quantities demanded. Different quantities demanded at the same set of prices. Now notice, here's a quantity demanded of 250. Here was a quantity demanded of 250 also. Going from a quantity demanded of 100 to 250 here, this did not represent an increase in demand. It represented merely an increase in quantity demanded along one and the same demand schedule. This represents an increase in demand. Why? Because this is an increase in quantity demanded not resulting from a decrease in price. This is an increase in quantity demanded resulting from a change in one of the other factors, one of the things that we had previously been holding equal. See, the demand curve and the supply curve are attempts to isolate the effect on quantities demanded or supplied of one variable and one variable only, and that's price. The demand curve is relating a quantity demanded to price only. Now, are there any other things that affect quantities demanded besides price? What are some things? Well, that can be a factor influencing price, but I'm asking what affects quantity demanded? What would affect... Pardon me? Well, I'm asking, I'm getting answers, cost of production, supply. Can you name things that are affecting quantities people are attempting to buy? Income, their income. What happens if people's incomes rise? Then what will that do to the quantities of most things that they'll attempt to buy at the same prevailing prices? They'll want to buy more at the same prevailing prices. But what does that represent in terms of demand? Then we would say the demand has increased. Now, that could be the kind of factor present here. Let's say people's incomes have gone up, and now at the price of $10, instead of only wanting to buy 100, they want to buy 250. Well, what explains why they want to buy 250 at the same price? Something else has had to change, such as their incomes going up. If their incomes go down, what should we expect to happen to the amounts they'll be attempting to buy at any given set of prices? That would go down. Then there'd be a decrease in demand. Now, there are many, many factors that can change demand, and let's start to look at them. Hopefully, the basic idea is clear. Let me put the curves back on. Changes in quantity demand along a given curve do not represent changes in demand. This is merely changes in quantity demanded as part of the same unchanged demand. This is a change in demand. Going from this curve to this curve, that's a change in demand. And here we're going from column 2 to column 4. Going from this curve back to this curve, that would be a decrease in demand. A change in demand is a movement of the curve. A change in demand is a shift of the curve. And it is brought about by changes in variables other than price. If what's causing the change in quantity demanded is only the change in price, if that's all that's involved, then it's not a change in demand, it's movement along a given demand schedule. What causes a change in demand is a change in a variable other than price, such as, for example, income. And now we'll see there are many other factors that could be at work also. And this is point 7, reasons for changes in demand. Changes in. Well, a factor underlying general rises in income would be changes in the quantity of money in the economic system. Suppose the quantity of money is increased. Imagine that more money has come into the possession of people. What would you expect them to be attempting to do with much, most, or all of the additional money? They'll be trying to spend it. Now, we start off, there's some prevailing array of prices, and at those same prices, people will now be attempting to buy more simply because they have more money in their pockets, and that appears to give them a greater purchasing power. And that would be the fundamental factor operating to raise money incomes. See, suppose we start out, there's more money, and people are spending the new and additional money. Well, what does that do to the sales revenues of the sellers? That increases it. What's it do to their profits? So that's the income of many people. And then what will business firms be doing with most of the additional sales revenues? They'll be spending them, reinvesting them. And what does that do? What does that represent about the demand for labor? There's a greater demand for labor. More people may be employed. Their incomes will be higher if they were unemployed or working in lower level jobs. And wage rates may very well go up too. That increases the incomes of everybody else. And so here you have the foundation of the rise in money incomes, the increase in the quantity of money. But then there are further factors, some of which we've discussed, notably the prices of substitutes. If the price of a given substitute changes, that's how we looked at it, if the price of beef goes up, we saw, okay, the quantity demanded of beef would go down, we'd be moving up the demand curve for beef, a higher price, a lower quantity demanded. But if the price of beef goes up while the price of pork, chicken, and fish, etc., stay the same, what is the effect on the demand for pork, chicken, lamb, and fish? Pardon me? That would increase, because even at now, with the higher price of beef, people will want to shift to the substitutes whose prices have not as yet risen, and they'll be attempting to buy more of those things at unchanged prices. So this represents the source of a rise in the demand for the substitutes for beef. Conversely, if the price of beef falls, what will that do to the quantities of the substitutes purchased at their unchanged prices?
Decrease.
So that would be a decrease in the demand for those substitutes. So it's important to realize that any time the price of a substitute changes, from the perspective of that given substitute, you'll have a movement along its demand curve. But at the same time, there will be a change in the demand curves for all of the other substitutes. Because this is a factor operating to change the quantities purchased at unchanged prices of the substitutes. So a change in the price of one thing will be a movement along its demand curve, but at the same time operate to shift the demand curves of the other substitutes. Now there's another very important category of connection between goods, and this is complements. There are complementary goods. These are goods which have to be employed together in order to achieve the desired result. And there, all kinds of things are complementary goods. Automobiles and gasoline are complementary goods. Steel, rubber, lead, paint, whatever, glass, these are complementary goods in the production of automobiles. Lumber, nails, the services of carpenters, plumbers, electricians, these are complementary goods in the construction of houses. So complementary goods are goods that have to be employed together to achieve some result. Well, what do you think is the effect of a change in the price of any complementary good on the demand for the other complements? Pardon me? An increase in the price of gasoline will be a factor reducing the demand for automobiles. Why? Well, at an unchanged price of gasoline, I'm sorry, at an unchanged price of automobiles, if the price of automobiles is unchanged, what is the effect of a higher price of gasoline on the total cost of ownership of an automobile? It increases it. And now, if we apply the law of demand to the total cost of ownership, what should we expect to happen to the number of units, the number of total complementary units of automobiles plus gas? Conceive the good not just as an isolated automobile, but as the automobile plus the gasoline, plus the necessary automobile insurance, plus whatever else enters into the use and enjoyment of a car. Conceive of it that way. What should we expect to happen to the quantity demanded of the overall total packages as the total cost of the combined elements goes up? Yes? The quantity demanded should decrease. Now, the only thing whose price has increased in our example is the price of gasoline. But the quantity demanded, it's part of the total cost of ownership of a car. As the total cost of ownership is greater, the number of units of automobile ownership and enjoyment that people will seek to acquire is diminished. And they'll be reducing their purchase of automobiles even though the price of automobiles is unchanged. So there's a general principle that changes in the price of any given complement operate to change the demand for all of the other complements in the opposite direction. A rise in the price of any complement will operate to reduce the demand for all of the other complements. The prices of the other complements even if unchanged, the demand will be less. The prices of the other complements, at unchanged prices of the other complements, people will buy fewer of them if the price of any given complement is higher. As the price of any given complement falls, what should be the effect on the demand for the other complements? Then the demand rises. So if the price of gasoline falls, that would be good for the demand for automobiles. And then if we look back at the income effect, what do you think is the effect of a fall in the price of food or any necessity of any kind on the demand for practically everything else? It would work to increase the demand for everything else. See, people's first need is to satisfy their need for hunger. But as they can do that, spending less money, well, the great bulk of the funds released will make it possible for them to afford more of other things. So as the price of food or any other necessity falls, the effect will be to raise the demand for practically everything else. Yes, Mr. Timotek.
Just to clarify, you're saying the price of gas increases, but that doesn't really follow that the demand decreases, but does the quantity of demand, can you say that the quantity of demand decreases, or do you have to actually move to a different
Demand schedule? You're saying, are you asking, as the price of gasoline increases,
correct.
Okay, then what?
So the price of gas increases, the demand is for buying automobiles is going to decrease.
The demand for automobiles and anything else complementary to gasoline will decrease.
The quantity of demand for
gasoline itself?
For the automobile will stay on the same demand schedule.
No.
Do you include the price, the rise in the price of gas, include that to the price of the automobile?
No. Let's say there's no change in the price of automobiles.
Right.
At least not at first. All we've had is a rise in the price of gasoline. Then I'm saying there'll be this rise in the price of gasoline will operate to reduce the demand for cars. People will be tending to buy fewer cars at the same price of cars. Why? Because the total cost of owning and operating an automobile is now higher. They will be purchasing fewer units of automobiles in combination with the ability to enjoy them.
Just to clarify, that's good. You define it as a change in demand, it's not going to be a change in quantity.
Well, there will be a number of things. There's a decrease in the quantity demanded of gasoline. There'll be some decrease in the quantity demanded of gasoline. That's along a given demand for gasoline.
Right.
It's not that the demand for gasoline has fallen. We have a higher price and a smaller quantity demanded along one and the same demand schedule. But the demand for automobiles, automobile insurance, motel rooms, ski resorts, whatever is complementary to automobiles, those demands will fall. Because that means even at the same price of automobiles, motel rentals, motel rates, ski resort rates, etc., people will be tending to purchase smaller quantities of them as the result of the higher price of gasoline, which makes the cost of carrying these things out higher, the total cost higher. Now, this element would work. Let's even suppose that there was a higher price of gasoline, and there's not yet a significant reduction in the quantity of gasoline demanded. There'd almost certainly be some. But even so, what will be the effect on the demand for these other things?
Okay. That's the price of gasoline increases?
Yeah.
It'll decrease.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Tse?
Can we further analyze the scenario and say that perhaps the demand for the more economical vehicle would rise? So the total purchases of automobiles remain relatively flat.
Okay, now Mr. Say is introducing a further detail of analysis, saying that people might end up buying pretty much the same number of automobiles, but they'll be looking to buy automobiles with lower gas consumption, smaller automobiles. Now, that's true, but notice when we say there is a reduction in the demand for automobiles, I think that would incorporate this kind of case. If people have been buying Lexuses, and now they're shifting more heavily to buying Corollas, from the point of view of Toyota, that's a reduction in demand. You see, a reduction in demand is not that if they're buying, if they're substituting smaller, cheaper units for larger, more expensive units, that's equivalent to buying fewer units. We would have to say that each Corolla is the equivalent perhaps of half of a Lexus or whatever. So if now they're buying Corollas instead of Lexuses, that's a reduction in demand. Yes, Mr. Underwood.
Would that be the substitution effect in that scenario?
Yeah, this would be the substitution effect, exactly. If they're shifting down to smaller, lower-priced cars, they're in competition. The one is a substitute for the other. So that would be a good example of the substitution effect. And we have, you see, these effects are intertwined. We have a rise in the price of a complementary good. It's reducing the demand for the other complements. And as part of that, the substitution effect can be at work too, shifting the kind of other complements that are purchased. People will shift from larger, more expensive complements to smaller, less expensive complements. That would be part of it. Now, if we turn back to the income effect, we can see that as the price of virtually any necessity changes, there'll be enormous widespread effects on the demand for practically everything else in the economic system. To the extent that necessities are purchasable for less, that means that people have more money left over to buy whatever it is they want. So there'll be a tendency for the demand for virtually everything else to rise as necessities become cheaper. Correspondingly, if necessities become more expensive, the demand for everything else will tend to fall. And you can see this illustrated at present with the rise in the price of oil. We have a threat to the supply of oil. So oil is scarcer. That's raising its price. But as the price of oil and oil products go up, what does that do to the funds available for the purchase of most other things? If we regard oil and its products most mainly as necessities in a modern society, people won't be willing to cut back on them unless they absolutely have to. So as the price rises, there'll be some reduction in quantity demanded, but not a very great amount. And what's the effect on the amount of money being spent for oil and oil products as the price rises?
More money spent on oil.
More money is spent. As we'll see, this will be described as an inelastic demand. That's our next subject. And that means there's less money available to spend for other goods throughout the economy. And so this is a factor operating to reduce demand in the rest of the economy. And it's in this way that something like a rise in oil prices or any major necessity is capable of producing recession-type effects elsewhere in the economic system. All right, there are still further reasons for changes in demand. There can be a change in the state of knowledge. People might know more and decide, well, here's something we didn't fully appreciate in the past. We didn't know what its uses were. To take the example of oil again, when oil first became an economic good, its only product was kerosene. But what do you think happened as the array of oil products was increased? And here's the automobile that comes along, and then it's realized you can make gasoline out of petroleum and diesel fuel and one thing after another. People are recognizing there's greater and greater utility in oil. what would be the effect of that on the demand for oil? That would be operating to increase it. So this is a change in the state of knowledge. Now, another kind of example, when people came to believe that eating fats, animal fats, caused heart disease, well, what did this do to the demand for red meat? Then that would make it go down. So a change in people's knowledge or beliefs, this is a factor that can profoundly affect demand. People can have a change in their tastes and preferences for no apparent reason. There can be changes in fashion. These are elements that will change demand. Finally, development of new substitutes or of new complements. What do you think? The automobile is complementary to oil. What was the effect of the invention of and growing popularity of the automobile on the demand for oil? Obviously, it radically increased it. You can have new substitutes come on, like PVC pipe. Is that the right? I don't want to confuse PVC with PCB. PVC, that's polyvinyl chloride pipe. Okay, that's supposedly a very effective substitute for lead and copper pipe. So when that appeared, what happened to the demand for lead and copper pipe? That decreased. So new inventions can change demand. All kinds of things can change demand. Any questions on the subject of demand and supply before we go on to elasticity? Okay, well, let's turn to elasticity. Hopefully, we've established that other things being equal, the lower the price, the larger the quantity demanded. The higher the price, the smaller the quantity demanded. All right, that being said, there can be great differences in the degree to which changes in price result in changes in quantity demanded. We should expect that always the change in price will result in a change in quantity demanded in the opposite direction, but that change could be relatively small or it could be relatively great. And the concept of elasticity of demand is an attempt to quantify the degree of change in quantity demanded relative to the change in price. The concept of elasticity of demand is an attempt to quantify the degree of change in quantity demanded to change in price, relative to change in price. And basically, two categories of elasticity are considered, are two types of the demand. There are demands which are held to be elastic, and there are other demands which are held to be inelastic. And it's all a question of how great is the change in quantity demanded relative to the change in price. If the change in quantity demanded is small relative to the change in price, so the change in price is the predominant factor, there's relatively little expansion or contraction in quantity demanded compared to the change in price, such a situation is described as an inelastic demand. Now you can think of it in terms of an elastic waistband. The elasticity allows it to stretch. Well, the more it can stretch, the more the elasticity, the less it can stretch, the less the elasticity. In those cases in which a fall in price results in a relatively great degree of expansion in quantity demanded and a rise in price in a relatively great degree of contraction in quantity demanded, that would be called an elastic demand. If the rise in price results in relatively little contraction and a fall in price in relatively little expansion, that's called an inelastic demand. Now, we can be more precise than that, and this is where point two, the total revenue test comes in, or equivalently, you could say the total expenditure test. They're the same. The expenditure on one side is the revenue on the other. If when the price of something falls, the quantity demanded increases in greater proportion, so that the total amount of money spent is greater at the lower price than at the higher price, that would be evidence of an elastic demand. If, for example, and this is the paradigm you might keep in mind, if when the price halves, the quantity demanded more than doubles, that would be an elastic demand. If when the price of something were to halve, the quantity demanded were to increase by more than double, well, how much would be spent on the thing at the halved price compared to the original price? If when the price of something halves, the quantity demanded were to triple, how much is spent at the half price compared to the original price?
One and a half.
One and a half. More would be spent at the lower price than at the higher price. How does it happen that more is spent at the lower price than at the higher price? Well, the increase in quantity demanded outweighs the decrease in price. The quantity demanded triples while the price is cut only in half. So wherever the expansion in quantity demanded is greater than the decline in price, as manifested in more money being spent at the lower price, that's an elastic demand. If when the price doubled, the quantity demanded were more than halved, if when the price doubled, the quantity demanded were cut to a third, well, then what would be true of the amount of money spent at the higher price? Pardon me?
Do 1.5 times plus?
It would be two-thirds as much. If one-third is the quantity purchased at twice the price, what, which element would outweigh which?
Loss in revenue outweighs the amount of the price increase.
I mean, there's a loss in revenue, and the loss in revenue occurs despite the doubling of price. So what's the other factor that explains the loss in revenue, the reduction in revenue?
The reduction in quantity demanded,
it goes to a third. The rise in price is up by a factor of two. If the quantity demanded is a third times two is two-thirds, so the revenue is less. The reduction in quantity demanded outweighs the rise in price. So what sort of demand would this be?
Elastic.
This would be an elastic demand. The way to conceive of an elastic demand is if the total amount of money spent to buy something is greater at a lower price and less at a higher price, that's an elastic demand. If the total amount of money spent to buy something, other things being equal, will be greater at a lower price and less at a higher price, that's an elastic demand. It means the change in quantity is outweighing the change in price. The quantity is tripling when the price halves, the quantity is being cut to a third. When the price doubles, the revenue is moving in the opposite direction of the price. If the revenue moves in the opposite direction of the price, the demand is elastic. Because what explains the revenue moving in the opposite direction of the price is the change in the quantity demanded outweighing the change in the price. So if the revenue is greater at a lower price, smaller at a higher price, that's an elastic demand. And by the same token, if the change in price outweighs the change in quantity, that's an inelastic demand. Suppose when the price doubles, people, while they're buying less, they're only buying 10% less. They're buying 9/10 as much at double the price. what would be the effect on the amount of money spent and received in this example? The price is doubled, the quantity demanded is 0.9.
Right.
The revenue has increased, the revenue would be 1.8. Well, here we are, the price has doubled, the revenue has, the quantity demanded has fallen only by 10%. This would mean we have relatively little shrinkage in quantity demanded, a relatively great rise in price. The rise in price outweighs the fall in quantity demanded. This is an inelastic demand. The revenue is greater at the higher price. The sign of an inelastic demand is revenue moving in the same direction as price. If revenue goes up when price goes up and down when price goes down, the demand is inelastic. It means there's relatively little stretch or shrinkage compared to the change in price.
What would that qualify if they were exactly the same, if they doubled and the demand doubled?
Would that be considered? I mean, if the price doubled?
And they're cut in half.
Okay, very good question. What is the situation if the changes in price and change in quantity demanded are inversely proportionate? So if the price doubles, the quantity demanded neatly halves. If the price halves, the quantity demanded neatly doubles. That situation has a name that's called unit elastic demand. Unit elastic demand, that's a kind of borderline case that's right between elastic and inelastic. At the level of microeconomics, such a case would probably exist only by accident. But at the macroeconomic level, that case is very, very important because if it's true that the amount of spending in the economy depends on the quantity of money, if the amount of spending in the economy depends on the quantity of money, what should we expect to happen to total aggregate spending if the quantity of money were unchanged? If we had an economy with an unchanged quantity of money and the other basic elements were unchanged, what should we expect about total spending? That it should stay the same. Now, if we have unchanged total spending in the economy, what should we expect to happen to whatever extent the total supply of goods and services offered for the unchanged spending were to increase or decrease? Suppose the total aggregate output of the economy were to double, and there's the same total spending to buy the doubled output. What would be implied about the general level of prices? Yes?
Come down.
Down how much?
Half.
Half. So at the level of the aggregate economy, where the total spending can reasonably be viewed as basically determined by the quantity of money, there, I think there is real application for unit elastic demand. But at the level of microeconomics, a unit elastic demand situation would almost be impossible, because any time the price of any one thing in isolation were to change, what does that do via the substitution effect? Should we expect that there'll be the same amount of money spent for a good that has substitutes? I certainly wouldn't think so. But at the level of the economy as a whole, there is application. Okay, I see we've passed the cutoff time for the break by a couple of minutes. So why don't we take a break? While we're out on break, think of anything that might be a little bit fuzzy in your minds, and maybe we can thrash it out when you return. So, see you in 25 minutes.